Hi.
Hello.
Hey. I'm going to read off my cell phone because I saw someone do it at AWP and it seemed really cool. Okay. There's something about Peter Schumacher that makes me want to give him books. We're all readers here. Well, most of us anyway. But Peter's a special kind, voracious and critical and generous-minded, willing to follow writers down deep rabbit holes to see what they're up to. His reading taste favors the digressive, the wild, the absurd, the Golden Ass and Rabelais, Roberto Bolaño and Cesar Ira, and even some writers who write in English. It's really good, he'll say, about some strange new directions book, and that laconic Indiana by way of, Colorado way. And you'll want to read whatever it is and find more stuff to feed in his brain to see what comes out. For the last 3 years, or more, I think, what's been coming out of his brain is this thing, this uncategorizable novel with indeterminate length, the most recent title of which I've seen is Untitled Novel in Progress, all in lowercase. It's about a young man named Stephen Polk doing time at a nature rehabilitation center in Colorado for drug abusers and sex offenders. Peter has attacked this story from angle after angle, and we've had the privilege of seeing this thing mutate in surprising, exhilarating ways. In some versions, Stephen has a covert and sinister homoerotic relationship with another camper. In some, a covert and sinister relationship with an older female teacher. He may grow up to look like Forrest Gump and design album covers. My favorite scene, which has been consistent across many drafts now, is Stephen drinking his grandfather's scotch and watching a VHS copy of Temple of Doom, taking a break only for an acid-induced march around the backyard with a possibly loaded rifle. No matter what version or section you read, it's awfully fucking good. Peter has one of the least predictable writing minds I know. He's an experimentalist in the good sense of the word. But he's got this story about these fucked up kids, and he's trying to get it right. So he keeps rewriting it, trying to find some final, ideal way of telling us about this community of impulsive violence. And teenage despair. Maybe his meditation gives him the patience he needs to keep tearing down the fictional edifice and building it back up again. Or maybe he's just driven by the fact that he knows he's got a big fish on the line. He's just got to hang on until he can haul it up on deck like some kind of old man in some kind of body of water. Whatever drives him, Peter's a wonderful workshop mate, movie watcher, dog owner, home brewer, whistler. He and his girlfriend, Kyla, are the neighbors we strive to be. Lending out their backyard for barbecues and battle ropes, and ready for pizza and air mattresses when their shiftless friends get especially shiftless. There's a great conversation in Peter's novel in which Stephen and his teacher paramour talk about whether or not people in real life change the way they do in novels. There's always something that does not change, says the teacher. It's a little unclear to me why that's my concluding line, but the idea is something like, Peter, don't go a-changing. I love you just the way you are. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Schumacher.
Oh, shucks. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, everyone who's here. And thanks, everyone who's not here. So I'll just read the first few pages from the novel I'm trying to write. So the sections are pretty short, too. One. Oh, I also wanted to just say thanks to my brother Joe and his fiancée Sarah for making it out here. That's really awesome. And also, is this loud enough?
Yeah.
Okay. One. It was Danny who jerked off into my hygiene box. I didn't know how he got hold of my hygiene box. My hygiene box contained my shampoo and my soap, and it was all covered in jizz. I washed my shampoo and my soap in the sink, but I couldn't tell if all the semen was gone. There was definitely still some semen pooled in the corner of my hygiene box. I'd been at the Langley Center for a year. I was 17 years old. I left the bathroom at the sink running and found Danny playing video games in the common area with Skylar. The shampoo bottle was still in my hands. I stepped between Danny and the TV. Danny said, "Move it, faggot." I said, "I know what you did to my hygiene box." I was honestly surprised to find that the plastic of the shampoo bottle was hard enough to break Danny's nose. I didn't intend to break his nose. Two living coordinators restrained me. I writhed under the weight of two grown adults. I cried rape on the floor. Restraints always felt like a violation, no matter how much I deserved them. The LC said, "Calm down, shh, deep breaths." In the periphery of my vision, I caught glimpses of Danny's bloody nose, of Skylar rushing back to his friend with a wad of paper towels. I struggled, but the LCs were stronger than me. They got my arms and legs under control. They rolled me onto my stomach. They said, "Calm down, stop screaming," but I kept screaming. 2. The judge sent me to DYC for 2 weeks. Nothing happened there, and I was happier. Then the judge sent me back to Langley. The judge called me Steve, and I called the judge Edward. It seemed like everything was a joke to Edward. I returned to Langley after lunch, during the second half of the school day, thinking about the mind, which was my main problem then. I was trying to inhabit the porous, luminous mind I'd known on acid, which according to Alan Watts was the ultimate reality. I was a walking cliché. I'm not exactly sure how I stumbled upon Alan Watts. In English class, I told Mrs. Vasquez that I'd rather be back at DYC. Mrs. Vasquez had butt-length dark hair. She smelled like raisins, and I believed I was in love with her. "If you wanted to stay at DYC, then why didn't you tell the judge?" Mrs. Vasquez said. "I did tell the judge," I said. I told him there's jizz everywhere at Langley. He just told me to watch my language, and I was like, what the fuck? Jizz is not a bad word. I said, "Edward, please, don't send me back." And thus, he sent me back. I always tried to use the word thus when I spoke to Mrs. Vasquez. She absorbed this newest use of the word with a smile. "You're a silly boy," she said. I believed I was in love with her. She gave me a copy of Tom Sawyer and told me I had some catching up to do. "We'll be discussing Chapter 6 on Friday," she said. I took a seat and got cracking. The class was smaller than ever, down to just Jason and Skylar and Ricky the Cowboy. They were gathered around the TV watching Overboard with Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. Danny was across the hall in science with the sex offenders. We'd been put into different classes, and that was a small victory for me. Danny hated the SOs more than anyone. The first sentence in Tom Sawyer was, "Tom!" The second sentence was, "No answer." I don't remember the third sentence, the fourth sentence. I read on into words I can't recall. Eventually, Skylar got up and started reading over my shoulder. In a girl's voice, he said, "Tom, Tom, Tommy boy." He laughed like an idiot and said, "Danny's gonna fuck you up. He's gonna come on all your personal items, and then he's gonna smash your face with something heavy. He doesn't know what yet, but it's gonna be something heavy, like a baseball bat." I said, "Thanks, Skylar, for the heads up." I was fairly sure there were no baseball bats on campus. 3. "Did you learn anything in DYC?" Nicole said. I sat on the couch in her log cabin style office in the admin building. Everything was log cabin style at Langley. It was rumored that Langley used to be a Christian summer camp that had to close down when a camper hanged himself in the bathroom of what is now Cubs Lodge. The overhead lights were off, the blinds were drawn, and Lady, Nicole's purebred Australian shepherd, was curled up on the floor. Lady's eyes were blue like a person's. She was the smartest dog I'd ever known. I liked to pretend that Lady, not Nicole, was my therapist. Nicole took notes of my talks so she could later translate them for Lady. She said, "Are you going to sit on the couch and sulk, or are you going to answer my question?" "I can't remember learning anything," I said. "You're still so angry," Nicole said. "But I'm not. I just want to go home." "Bullshit," Nicole said. "Home is where you were headed before this. Now it'll be another 6 months, and that's assuming you don't blow up again." "Whatever," I said. Nicole mimicked me. "Whatever, whatever." It seemed unprofessional, but I guess she was the kind of shrink with a look kid I'm going to level with you kind of attitude. I wanted them to go AWOL, to leave Nicole alone in her office. I got up from the couch, but the door was locked. Nicole told me to sit down. She went on talking. I stood at the door and tried not to listen to her. You've broken a peer's nose, and you're lucky to still be here. There are a lot of people here who care about you, but over and over again, you take them for granted. Over and over again, you get on the path, and then you lose it. Now, why might that be? Have you ever given it any thought? Have you ever given a moment's thought to how this anger and violence might affect your future? Nicole was being melodramatic. The answer was a resounding no. I had not thought about how my anger and violence would affect my future. These were all ridiculous conventional concepts. Alan Watts said the future was an illusion. I understood that. He said the past was an illusion too. That I didn't understand. The past was vivid and always there. It still is. I could see my dead grandfather, for example, who died my first year in treatment. He sits in the tweed upholstered lounge chair. He's drinking a scotch and eating a Hershey's bar. There are Hershey's wrappers at his feet, and issues of Time and National Geographic scattered on the Persian rug. He's smiling, eating, drinking, always in the present tense like this. He's watching the news. The TV glows in the corner. In the kitchen, I can hear my grandmother coughing over a mixing bowl. I know she's making a salad that calls for enormous quantities of mayonnaise. I can hear her mixing the mayo and the shredded carrots, but I can't see her. I tried to batter down the door, but it was designed to withstand this kind of angsty, overdone battering. He jerked off into my hygiene box. What the fuck was I supposed to do? Nicole said, use your words. Use the coping skills you've been developing. She said you need to learn to use your coping skills no matter what the blah, 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 blah. She spoke and she gestured. Her facial expression changed like a river, or like an alpine cloud now glowing white with sunlight, now gray and ready to storm. I wanted to go outside. I wanted to be alive in Langley Canyon with the birds and shit, and with the pine cones scattered everywhere reminding me of death. I loved nature the way I thought I was supposed to. I knew the trees were alive when I looked at them. It was true that I thought of death often, but still there was no real reason for me to be at Langley. A lot of the boys you could actually see killing themselves. You could understand why they'd do it. Their lives were hard. They'd helped bury murder victims. Their parents had burned them with torches. I'd only taken enough acid to lose my head a while. I was a spoiled private school punk. I experienced a thought. The classic image of Tom Sawyer is that of a boy in a straw hat dozing by a stream with a fishing line tied to his toe. But so far in the novel, there has been no such image. Then I thought maybe I mixed up Tom and Huck. Maybe it was Huck who snoozes in the sun with the fishing line tied around his toe. I've added you to the summer backpacking trip, Nicole said. Danny will be there too. It'll be an opportunity for the both of you to learn how to deal with your anger and work in the service of a common goal, survival in the great outdoors. 4. I returned to Avalanche Lodge. I sat in the common area where I'd been restrained for hurting Danny. Someone had knocked out the big plexiglass window while I was gone. The LCs had done a poor job replacing it. There were stripes of duct tape holding the window in its frame, and the mountain air drafted in uninhibited. It was summer, but we were at 9,000 feet. It still got cold at night. Many of the residents were gone, discharged or transferred. Marcus was gone, Kenny was gone, Raul was gone, Trey was gone. Back to the foster care system, or the street, or another facility. There were no new admits. 4 discharges and not a single new admit. It weighed on the minds of the LCs, the same pair of optimistic youth group-style Christians who restrained me 2 weeks ago. One of them was named Desmond. The other was named Rain. Rain often complained about her hippie parents. She believed she could relate to the Denver area gang kids because she, too, was raised in an environment of substance abuse. My parents smoked marijuana every day. We were down to just 5 residents, an all-time low. Neither Desmond nor Rain could explain it. "Pretty soon we'll be out of work," Desmond said. He thought he was funny. "At least there will be plenty of SOs." "There will always be plenty of SOs," Rain said. "Just today there were 2 new admins to Hawkeye Lodge." It pleased me to think that Danny must already know all about that. Danny, who was hiding in his room. We hadn't seen each other yet, and I entertained myself imagining what his nose looked like. I wanted it to feel funny. I wanted Danny to be grotesque. I sat on the couch imagining his nose until Rain announced it was time for chores. She doled out the jobs, and of course, in the interest of therapeutic living, Danny and I were paired together for bathroom duty. "And no semen and no broken noses," Desmond said. In the bathroom, we didn't say much. Danny was like this. He was half Mexican, and he insisted that he was from Denver and that his father was shot dead in the street in broad daylight. I'd heard him say it several times in group therapy. I'd seen Nicole roll her eyes, and I'd seen his father come to pick him up for home passes, very much Caucasian and dressed in his hospital scrubs. I spoke to his father once while the LCs were rounding Danny up from an AWOL saunter in the woods. His father was a surgeon, and in that way Danny and I were alike. My father was a surgeon. I asked Danny's father where he would be taking Danny on his home pass. Danny's father said Cantor. Cantor was one of those communities of prefab mansions and luxury townhomes between Colorado Springs and Denver, the kind that were like self-contained villages with their own post offices, grocery stores, schools, churches, hospitals, nodes of wealth cloistered from the outside world. We have them in Indiana too. Danny was a liar. He wasn't from the city any more than I was. "All the SOs were giving me the eyes today," Danny said. "They all want a taste of my cock." And to my surprise, he laughed, and he sounded genuinely amused. I decided he was probably fucking with me, waiting for me to let my guard down. I wiped down the mirror over and over so as to avoid dealing with the toilet, from which sewage fumes wafted upwards. My reflection didn't surprise me. I had a lot of acne, and my hair was getting to be as long as a girl's. I was pale and obviously malnourished. I sprayed Windex on my reflection and wiped it clean. I did it again. The mirror was very clean. I told Danny, "You better keep your butthole squeezed tight." 5. In the morning before school, Nicole and Holga dropped by to lead group therapy. It was the same as any cliche TV show. We sat in a circle and talked about our feelings. Holga asked everyone to report in for the day. She asked us to disclose a safety number. Everyone disclosed a 10. "I'm feeling very safe." We knew disclosing a low number was an invitation for Holga to interrogate us. Nicole and Holga sat in a circle with us. They had clipboards in their laps. The focus today was on Skyler and his tendency to hurt himself. Last night before lights out, he jumped off the second floor loft. He didn't break any bones, and he maintained that it was not a suicidal gesture. "I was bored," he said. I was bored, too. I tried to read Tom Sawyer. Everyone thought Tom was dead. Nicole told me to put my book away. She said it's true sometimes people do stupid things when they're bored. Holga looked at her as if she'd said something blasphemous. Holga was older than Nicole. She was a bird-boned woman with bleached hair and skin on her face that stretched tight over her cheekbones like plastic wrap. She said the real question is why Skyler was feeling so bored when there was plenty of treatment work to keep him occupied. "What about his life narrative, for example?" "Have you even begun to compose your life narrative?" Holga asked. "Typically, residents will compose a life narrative within the first 6 months of treatment, but I have yet to receive anything from you. And furthermore, Mr. Tony and Mrs. Vasquez have been complaining to me about your lack of participation in school. There must be plenty of readings and worksheets for you to catch up on. So forgive me if I'm a little confused as to why you might have been so bored." Her legs crossed tight, her gold fountain pen in one hand. Holga was so out of touch. We laughed at her, and someone suggested that maybe life narratives and schoolwork weren't quite the antidote to boredom she imagined them to be. Olga was unfazed by this assault on her integrity. She smiled without baring teeth and said, "Part of being a well-adjusted member of society is learning to take joy in one's responsibilities." And now I'm skipping over some stuff where the narrator talks about his own life narrative that he's been writing, but I'll skip that. So this is part 7. I was anxious to get back to Mrs. Vasquez and tell her what I thought of Tom Sawyer. Basically, I thought it was a good adventure story, but it felt a little light. It didn't come close to Damien to compare it to another Bildungs Roman, or even The Catcher in the Rye, which even at that age I wasn't fond of. Certainly, it was nowhere near the majesty of Narcissus and Goldman. And all of the adults were unrealistically clueless. I anticipated Mrs. Vasquez saying something like, "Is that really so unrealistic?" Her identity construct had to do with believing in children and the future. She didn't identify with adults. I didn't consider myself a child, but I was happy to be considered a child by Mrs. Vasquez. To be considered by Mrs. Vasquez at all, that was perhaps my sole desire in those days. I don't know why. I fixated on her immediately upon my admission. My dreams were full of sex. Nicole said I should masturbate in the shower stalls, never in bed. The shower stall was therefore like an upright coffin where a phantom Vasquez lived. In my dreams and in my waking life, Mrs. Vasquez wore hand-knitted wool socks constantly. She treated me as if I was perfectly capable of thinking about the world. English class wasn't until after lunch, though, and first I had to sit through breakfast and several hours of math and science. So I ate a breakfast burrito and a donut, and I watched a documentary about feathered dinosaurs. The documentary was full of shitty CGI sequences in which these feathered dinosaurs were fully imagined. Each one was an exotic tropical thing, brilliantly multicolored. No dinosaur was covered in, say, monochrome brown feathers. I didn't understand it. Where was the house wren of the Cretaceous period? The documentary didn't say. The documentary made no mention of any evidence experts may have used in hypothesizing these color schemes. I understood that we now believe dinosaurs were feathered because of X or Y or Z. And by the way, the first person to propose that birds were descended from dinosaurs was Thomas Henry Huxley, Aldous Huxley's grandfather, a fact which amazed me. I was amazed at the time by Aldous Huxley and The Doors of Perception and Brave New World and Island. But why assume the feathers were beautiful? It seemed like a leap to me, and not necessarily a minor one. These experts wielded influence over imaginations. They changed what a dinosaur was in my head. Dinosaurs used to be dark green or gray or brown claymation beasts. Now they were something like digital parrots. It frightened me and amused me that a dinosaur could change like that. The documentary ended with a pterodactyl flying into a sunset and a monologue on the beauty and mystery of nature. Then Mr. Tony sent us to lunch. It was Taco Wednesday. Taco Wednesday was my favorite day of the week. I ate 5 tacos. I ate them quickly, and I spent the rest of the lunch period reading Tom Sawyer. The townspeople were preparing the funeral for Tom and company, but I couldn't really follow it, because 2 of the little guys at the next table were squealing like piglets. They were flinging taco meat with plastic spoons. I resolved myself to read by thinking of Mrs. Vasquez and her green eyes. I thought of her face like sandstone after the rain. I would speak to her soon. I read another sentence. The villagers begin to converse in whispers about the sad event. But in the end, I didn't even make it to English, because Curtis now hovered above me, saying, "Stephen, hey Stephen, how's it going? Staying safe? Staying positive? Hey, listen, I'd like to borrow you for a minute." He took 5 of us outside to the ropes course behind the school. Danny, Skyler, myself, and 2 SOs from Hawkeye. The white one with the purple cape and the rat tail was Anthony. But the other one I didn't recognize, a new advent. He was black and he had a big smile with crooked teeth. Curtis called us the Watt. He waited for us to guess his meaning. He was barely able to contain his enthusiasm. Wilderness Adventure Team, he finally cried, throwing his hands in the air.